Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group and the Intellectual Property Rights Practice Group. It was recorded on Tuesday, February 19, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, a special courthouse edition on the Bowman versus Monsanto case argued in the Supreme Court earlier today. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. And, as usual, our call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. As is our habit, we'll hear brief opening remarks from each speaker of about 5 to 10 minutes, and then maybe some back and forth between the two speakers, and then we'll get to the questions from the audience. We'll begin with Mr. Doug Nelson. He's a senior advisor for trade, intellectual property, and strategic issues for CropLife America, the largest national trade organization representing developers, manufacturers, formulators, and distributors of agricultural pesticides across the United States. He'll be followed by Adam Mossoff, professor of law at George Mason University Law School, where his work focuses on intellectual property. He's also one of the founders of the Law School Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. And their larger bios, or longer bios, have been provided to you that you received in the notice of today's call, also available on our website. So that's all I'm going to say about their credentials today, and we'll get right to the discussion. Doug Nelson, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. I really appreciate this, and thank the Federal Society for holding this conference. And might say, just to begin, that I think both Adam and I are probably going to be very pleased to report on the results today at the court, not to give anything away in advance, but it was a very animated and energetic, and hopefully we think positive result will come from it. This case, just to give a little bit of quick background for everyone, this case involves soybean seeds developed by Monsanto. They've been genetically engineered to tolerate a widely used herbicide called Roundup, and the seeds themselves then become known as Roundup Ready seeds. These seeds can tolerate Roundup, and so as a result, farmers do not have to do any backbreaking weeding or labor. They can just spray their fields, kill all weeds, allow the Roundup Ready soybeans to grow. Monsanto, of course, took a lot of time, effort, and scientific development to create these, and as a result, they charge a premium for these patented Roundup Ready soybean seeds. The farmers who buy the seeds must agree not to use the seeds for more than a single generation, i.e., they're not permitted to use the seeds that are produced by the soybeans they grow from the Roundup Ready seeds. And if they were permitted to do so, they would not need to buy any more seeds from Monsanto going forward because all such second-generation seeds carry the same Roundup-tolerant genetic trait. The case involves one Indiana farmer, Vernon Bowman, who sought to, in our eyes, avoid paying a premium price by purchasing what's called commodity soybeans grown by other farmers. These are stored at silos, and they are usually sold for feed purposes or food purposes, not for growing seeds. Vernon Bowman, correctly suspecting that these commodity soybeans were probably Roundup Ready, and that's because over 90% of the seeds now used by farmers in the United States are Roundup Ready, he bought them, he planted the seeds he obtained from these commodity soybeans, and then he applied Roundup to the growing plants. That obviously was successful, since most of the seeds he purchased were Roundup Ready, killed the weeds, allowed the soybeans to grow. He then repeated this process for nearly a decade, replanting the seeds from each generation of soybeans that he grew. When Monsanto discovered what Bowman was doing, it sued him for patent infringement, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit rejected Bowman's argument that the patent exhaustion doctrine barred that lawsuit. The court entered judgment in favor of Monsanto. Today, we were at the Supreme Court because the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take the cert petition that Bowman's lawyers had proposed. And so we had oral argument today by both Bowman's lawyers, Monsanto's lawyers, and the Solicitor General also. I thought with the patent arguments addressed, I'd turn it over to Professor Madoff, who could give you a little bit more background on that, and then both he and I can come back and answer specific questions about what happened at the oral argument today. Adam?
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be speaking today for the Federal Society on the oral argument in Bowman v. Monsanto. So the case, which primarily focuses as a legal matter on patent law and the scope of the protections provided under patent law to innovative companies working in the biotech and agricultural industries like Monsanto, is very important. It reaches directly the types of incentives that the patent system provides for coming up with new innovative technology, like genetically modified seeds, and it speaks directly to how the patent system secures those incentives by providing the types of protections in the commercialization of that innovative technology when it's invented and distributed in the marketplace. So today, as Doug provided the background for, involved today's oral argument, or the case involves a farmer, Bowman, who came up with a very interesting strategic plan for getting around the fact that when he purchases these genetically modified seeds from Monsanto, they come with a restriction on them that he is to only use them once for planting and harvesting and then selling them to someone else, and that he is not to replant seeds. Monsanto essentially has two arguments that it has made from the get-go, from both in the district court on appeal and then eventually before the U.S. Supreme Court. The first is that Bowman is in fact engaging in direct infringement by making additional copies of the seeds by retaining the seeds that he purchases from the grain elevator and planting them and then retaining more seeds and replanting them, that he is making without authorization the patented invention, which is a direct violation of Section 271A of the Patent Act, which prohibits anyone from making without authorization a patented invention for the term of the patent. They also had a second additional argument that in addition to direct infringement, Bowman was violating the terms of the license granted to him. He acquired a restricted license that restricted him to only use the patented seeds once for purposes of growing, and that he wasn't to resave them for purposes of growing more plants. And this license restriction implicates a doctrine in patent law known as exhaustion doctrine, which states that when a patent owner sells a patented product in the marketplace without restrictions, that they lose all of their rights to in the patented product. It becomes a regular article of private property that can be freely sold and alienated and used in the marketplace. Bowman's response to these two arguments is not to deny directly the facts of what he has been doing, because he can't, but it was instead to make a broader argument that, in fact, there cannot be patent protection of the sort that Monsanto is attempting to obtain here under either both the direct infringement argument or the restrictive licensing argument, because seeds are a, quote, self-replicating technology, unquote. And as a self-replicating technology, seeds are therefore different from the type of mechanical inventions like machines or straightforward products like flashlights or something of that sort that can be covered by patents, that these products, seeds, naturally self-replicate, and therefore if you allow patent protection on these types of products, then you will necessarily create potential infringement ad infinitum, and we'll be expanding the scope of monopoly control over something that is naturally reproducing in the world, and that is unacceptable and violates underlying patent policy. So that was the framing basically of the two. Those are the framing of the two opposing arguments. In the oral argument today, it was very interesting. Because when Mr. Walters, Bowen's attorney, got up, he was immediately asked the first question by Chief Justice Roberts, which really struck to the very heart of the matter here, how could Monsanto sell genetically modified seeds under the argument being presented by Bowman? So how could Monsanto, which takes decades and invests hundreds of millions of dollars to come up with these genetically modified seeds, very similar to what happens in pharmaceutical context with therapeutic treatments, where it takes years, if not decades as well, and hundreds of millions, if not over $1 billion of sunk costs before a product reaches the market, how can they recoup their investments and therefore not only pay off those, pay down those sunk costs, but also make a profit if they were not secure against the type of activities that that Bowman was engaging in? This was a question that was touched on again and again and again throughout the initial argument by Bowman's attorney, Mr. Walters. It was picked up by Justice Breyer, who repeatedly emphasized through a hypothetical involving multiple generations of different seeds that the problem here isn't what Mr. Bowman did with the first generation seed that he purchased from Monsanto. The problem is what he did with generation 2 and generation 3 and generation 4, and ultimately, as Doug just mentioned, all the way up to generation 9 for up to upwards of a decade. And the problem is, problem starts with generation 3, of where he's replicating the seeds repeatedly, making the invention, and therefore directly infringing the scope of patent protection secured to Monsanto, in the same way that if someone made a copy of a flashlight or another type of patented product, that would be making the invention in an unauthorized way, and that would be an infringement too. Interestingly enough, the majority of time spent among the justices in questioning Mr. Walters was spent on this particular issue, that this is in fact a direct infringement, and that if they didn't find that this was a direct infringement, that this undermined completely all of the incentives that the patent system is intended to provide to companies working in the biotech and bioagricultural industries, when they are willing to make these investments of hundreds of millions of dollars to come up with these radical, innovative products like Ready Roundup soybeans. Justice Kagan, for instance, towards the end of Mr. Walters' initial opening argument, said I want to go back to Chief Justice Roberts' initial question and really, for lack of a better word, hammered on Mark Walters on the issue of that what Mr. Walters was proposing is that Monsanto could deploy contracts or some type of agency relationships to try to obtain the same type of protections that Monsanto was arguing that it achieved through the patent system. It didn't have to rely upon the patent system. And of course, Justice Kagan pointed out that no, contract is actually peculiarly insufficient here, because once one seed escapes from the particular crop that has been purchased from Monsanto, or once a seed is transferred to a third party, that third party, either whether it's direct transfer or it's an accidental transfer, is now not in privity, is not in contract privity anymore with Monsanto, and so therefore Monsanto could not go after that person. The Solicitor General was then given 10 minutes to speak, and the Solicitor General got up and continued to touch on the issue that this case is actually a direct infringement case. She pointed out that Justice Breyer was exactly correct. The exhaustion doctrine is irrelevant. They don't even need to reach the issue of licensing and exhaustion doctrine. They can decide this case on the grounds of direct infringement. She masterfully invoked the Supreme Court's prior decisions, particularly in JEM and in Microsoft versus AT&T, and reaching all the way back to Chakrabarty, where the Supreme Court has both ratified the existence of patent protection for seeds, specifically in JEM, has ratified patent protection for self-replicating living organisms, like bacteria in the Chakrabarty decision in 1980, and in Microsoft, the AT&T recognized that patent protection was extended to copies made from an initial product. In that case, it involved computer software. Seth Waxman, who was representing Monsanto, then got up and spoke and made the case for Monsanto. It was very interesting. Mr. Walters was heavily questioned from almost the first moment when he got up throughout the entire period of his speaking, although he reserved a few minutes for the end. The Solicitor General was questioned only very lightly, and for the first time in probably 10 or 20 or 25 oral arguments that I have actually listened to, I've never heard this before. Seth Waxman went for approximately 10 to 12 minutes of speaking without being asked a single question. And then when he was eventually started to be asked questions, they were not of the tenor or of the hard-hitting nature that of the questions that had been posed to Mr. Walters. They focused upon, again, the infringement issue. Mr. Waxman spent much of his time talking and answering questions that had been raised initially with Mr. Walters about the underlying technology and about the nature of soybean crops and whatnot. Mr. Waxman demonstrated a real knowledge and facility of awareness of the technology and the agricultural industry in which this technology is situated. And he very masterfully showed on the spot, given the nature of what he witnessed with the questions and answers with Mr. Walters, he gave up the exhaustion or the licensing argument and conceded that, even though he spent probably about half of his brief on that issue, he conceded that and said, you don't need to reach that issue. You can decide this case on the infringement issue. In fact, you should only decide this case on the infringement issue. So that's just a quick summary of the oral argument, and I'll pass back to Doug, and then we can perhaps open it up for questions and answers.
Thank you, Adam. I would reaffirm everything that Adam has just said. It was quite a difference between the two oral petitioners in discussion. Just a few points, maybe, to emphasize. Justice Breyer's discussion of the three generations was a very simple way to understand the analogies that were being made in the case. And we should just remind everyone what this is, in a sense. The first generation seed is the seed that obviously you buy from a seed company, and that was a very important point, that the way Mr. Bowman purchased his commodity seed was from a grain elevator. And in actuality, when you buy seed from a grain elevator, you can use that seed for feed, for eating, whatever. But technically, the grain elevator is not licensed to sell it as seed so that you could replant it and grow more seed. So there's actually a violation of usually state law in terms of licensing purposes. There's also potentially a violation of the Plant Variety Protection Act if a grain elevator is doing that. But that's precisely what Bowman did. No one picked up as a way to find another issue there, but it was it really was used, the information was used to convince the justices that, wait a minute, this is not a normal practice, because Mr. Bowman tried to make the case that this was potentially, or Bowman's lawyer, Mark Walters, that this was potentially a practice that is could be followed by a lot of farmers, but in point of fact, it really can't be. So first generation seed, you buy them, you can use them for any purpose. The second generation seed, which comes from growing of the crop, to some extent is you also can do what you want with them, but you can't grow the third generation seed. That's the violation. That's the infringement. And there was some real discussion about that, obviously Mr. Bowman explicitly violated that fact, and that's where the direct infringement issues come about, because he made a third generation, and as we know, even more than that. And patent law would prohibit the making of that patented invention. There was some a little bit of discussion about the fact that the word self-replicating was probably a total misnomer, since farmers had to do a lot. The seed just doesn't do it on its own. The concern about this violation was that it really, and Seth Waxman, I agree with Adam, did a phenomenal job of going right back to the beginning. If you followed the Bowman logic to its nth point, all generations of Roundup Ready seeds subsequent to the first would have been a violation, has to be undermined, because all of the seeds are the prodigy of that first Roundup seed. And this patent has been in existence from 1996 for this purpose. In a sense, it undermines the patent law permission of 20 years of exclusive use or sale. The plaintiff's argument, or Bowman's argument in this sense, reduces it just to the first sale back in 1996. I don't think there is much else that needs to be explicitly spelled out. I think your questions probably will bring out the rest. But it was a very animated discussion at the end, with some humor, hopefully, and not always supplied as is normally by Justice Scalia. Others joined in with comments. So with that, Dean, we'd pass it back to you for questions, perhaps.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We're going to open the floor to questions from the audience in a moment. You should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Adam Ossoff or Douglas Nelson, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. While we're waiting to see if someone rings in with a question, let me make our regular programming announcement about the calls for the balance of the week. We have tomorrow a broader look at recess appointments in the wake of the Noel Canning case. That will be tomorrow at 2 p.m. With a nice slate of speakers. On Thursday, we'll be talking about national security and intelligence leaks. That's Thursday at 12 noon. And then on Friday, we'll be talking about federal criminal prosecutions, Friday at 2 p.m. So three more calls for the week, and I hope you can join us for as many of those as possible. They'll all be taking place at the same number. For a complete schedule of calls, please visit the Federal Society's website. We have two callers now with questions, so let's go to our first question.
Thank you very much, George Reed Dellinger, Washington Analysis. Two questions. Why do you think the Supreme Court took this case? One, and would you venture a head count on how the justices would or would not vote?
This is Doug Nelson. I mean, that is the a question so many of us, George, have been asking ourselves. Obviously, the process in the court is that you need, in a sense, I guess, four clerks to have decided that it's worthy of taking. We do have four fairly liberal clerks, and perhaps those were the four. Maybe Adam has some more analysis of maybe concern about the quantum case or other patent cases in other areas. But obviously, in the GMO, there's a tremendous anti-GMO sentiment out there. It's very influential. Even on the steps of the Supreme Court today, there were some demonstrations. And, of course, the press has been very active. Both the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post has had articles about this Bowman case in the last week leading up to the case. So the pressure out there to relook at whether you can patent some of what some people are calling life, going all the way back to the Chaudhary case in 1980 or the rest, might be some of the pressure. But I don't have an answer per se, except supposition, and everyone I've asked doesn't have an answer. Both Adam and I think are going to be more than willing to give you a prediction, but why don't I let Adam see if he knows anything more about why they took the case.
Within the patent law community, in particular within the academic community, there has been a lot of consternation expressed over the previous 10 years or so about the patenting of genetically modified seeds. There's been a substantial number of Law Review's articles written on this issue, and this is tied in with, as Doug just mentioned, a broader concern about licensing restrictions that have been imposed upon purchasers and licensees of patented products and processes, as reflected in the Supreme Court's recent decision in Quanta Computers v. LG Electronics. And so I think that the Supreme Court probably granted cert in this case because of the general atmospherics that are surrounding the patent system today and the general perception among many in the public debates that the patent system is broken, is a cliche one often hears, and that patent owners have too strong protections being offered to them. The problem is that that narrative does not fit this case. In fact, I would argue that that narrative doesn't fit many of the cases, but in this particular case, the narrative was so contradicted the basic facts of this case that after the arguments were submitted, I think the Supreme Court then realized exactly the nature of the situation that they had. So there were a lot of, for instance, assertions by the petitioner, by Bowman, and by supporting academics, for instance, that Monsanto is, in fact, suing innocent infringers where seeds blow onto patented seeds blow onto other crop, other farmers' parcels through the wind and through weather conditions, and that Monsanto was bringing infringement actions, patent infringement actions against these people who couldn't prevent this from happening, and that's in fact untrue. In fact, Monsanto has an explicit policy against doing that, which makes complete sense both on simple PR grounds, but also on patent law grounds. And so once they got through a lot of the rhetoric and what I think are some of the mistaken public perceptions, they realized what this case boils down to is you have a deliberate, willful infringer. You have a farmer who wants the benefit of this patented technology without having to pay for it. And he came up with a very interesting, convoluted scheme in order to do that. But at the end of the day, it was a scheme that was an infringement scheme. And again, Seth Waxman's brief in this case, it was just masterful in both addressing the underlying facts and the factual inaccuracies that were asserted by the petitioner, as well as the underlying legal basis for their claims. And I don't normally like to make predictions about Supreme Court decisions or where they're going to come out, but in this case, given the tenor of the oral argument, I would be very surprised if Monsanto does not win this case.
This is Doug Nelson. I might just add to what Adam has said. Justice Kagan in particular asked about the drift issue, and Seth Waxman did a masterful job explaining how, because of the nature of the soybean plant, there really isn't a drift problem of this sort, and it would be so de minimis in some ways that never would Monsanto be out there being able to sue on that basis. The other thing, just to put in context, since it was mentioned, is that there actually are 280,000 soybean farms in this country, and they've been using this technology now for over 16 years. And over the course of time, Monsanto has only brought contract license actions, against 144 farmers, less than 10 a year. So there is not an epidemic of this kind of violation that Monsanto is out suing farmers right and left. And so those facts are very important. They didn't need to be brought out in this case today, but that's some of the statistics that have been supplied by many of the amicus briefs, because the soybean associations and so many of the other innovative technology associations have made sure that they've submitted information bolstering the Monsanto approach to patent law and the rest. My prediction is similar to Adam's. I mean, it almost at the end of the day could almost look unanimous, because while Justice Ginsburg asked one question, Seth was able to set her right in terms of how this farming procedure works. I mean, the odds, I think, are going to be a very strong pro Monsanto position, probably with concurrences from some of the others to liberal judges to justices to limit, you know, any broader scope. But I can't see how they can avoid a direct infringement response to what Bowman had done.
Yes, on the issue of possible concurrences, I just want to point out for those who are aware of kind of the debates in the patent law world and kind of the narrative of the past 10 years that much of the reason why the Supreme Court has gotten involved in patent jurisprudence again after taking some time off from it, relatively speaking, in the 80s and 90s, is because of the perception of the Federal Circuit not following the law and not being respectful of the Supreme Court precedents and existing case law. I do expect that there might be a concurrence from Sotomayor, and possibly joined by some of the other justices, because she did ask a substantial number of questions and engage in some dialogue, especially with Seth Waxman on the patent exhaustion and licensing issue. And she was one of the few justices who actually explicitly said to him, shouldn't we reach this issue of the conditional license? And she said, shouldn't we reach this issue to address this issue because of, quote, lingering confusion by the Federal Circuit, end quote, about what this requires under the law after our Quanta decision. And again, Seth Waxman did a really good job saying, a better case will come up for that. You will need to address that issue at some point. This is not the case that you need to address it. This case, the facts presented much can be decided upon the infringement issue. Leave that for another day. It's not necessary. But she did seem very interested in sending another signal to the Federal Circuit that perhaps at least she and perhaps some of her fellow justices think that the Federal Circuit is still taking an inappropriate view with respect to licensing doctrines within patent law and patent exhaustion doctrine.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Let's go to our next caller. If you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. At this point, we have one additional question, then our lines will be open. So push star and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Jim Arkowski in New York. I don't know if you're familiar with the European Court of Justice decision in the used soft case, which basically gave a very expansive view of the first sale doctrine. And if you were to, by analogy, apply it to a situation like Monsanto, high probability that the European Court of Justice would view the first sale here as an exhaustion of the patent. I'm wondering, you know, two questions, whether you would have any thoughts on how the EU would view the patent rights in this situation, and secondly, if the EU were to say that once Monsanto sells the seeds for the first time, that's it, it loses control, how would Monsanto protect its patent rights in preventing a sale in the U.S., gets the soybean seed gets shipped to the EU and then can be sold over and over again, multiple generations?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know the European case that you refer to, so I can't speak to how the European courts would extend their decision in that case to this case. I'm sorry for that, but I can speak to your second question about the issue of the what does it mean for Monsanto to have its patents exhausted after any transfer of a patented seed to a farmer or any other party. And in fact, this was the issue that repeatedly came up throughout the entire oral argument. And in fact, the attorney from the Solicitor General's office really made a really excellent argument about the importance of this issue and why the exhaustion doctrine doesn't apply. She said that if you, speaking to the justices, she says, if you rule for Bowman in this case, she says, you will. This would essentially reduce the 20-year term of the patent to a single first sale by Monsanto of its patented seed, because what Bowman is saying is that every sale means automatic complete 100% exhaustion, and you can't impose restrictions on those sales, on what people may do with the product, even directly. And moreover, that the seed, since it's self-replicating and can escape control, it will and does get out. And so that would mean that Monsanto would have to find someone, a single purchaser, willing to spend upwards of maybe $1 billion on its genetically modified soybean seed in order for it to recoup its research and development and earn enough profits to continue doing further research and development of new seed technology, which I think brings home in a rather dramatic fashion the nature of this patent exhaustion argument and why the justices were virtually unanimous in rejecting it, at least it has appeared in oral argument, given that this would run counter to the very nature of what the policy system is, what the policies are in the patent system to secure to people their productive labors by ensuring them an exclusive right of a property right that they can take out into the market, commercialize it, and profit from.
Doug Nelson, did you have anything on this point?
No. I defer to the real patent expert.
Okay. Well, our lines are open. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open at the moment. You both, I think, alluded to the chief's opening question about if someone can't protect their patent rights, who would bother to grow and create and innovate a seed that someone else could regenerate and then market themselves or use for their own use? What was the answer to that question? I'm curious.
I think, obviously the Bowman lawyer avoided that question, basically because he's still maintaining, even though I think it was knocked down fairly successfully, that Monsanto had the ability to protect its rights through contract or some kind of agency agreement. Seth Waxman obviously very successfully indicated that, to some extent, and this is where I defer to Adam again, the whole patent structure of this country would be in jeopardy. There's no question, and people should understand the cost that was involved in the generation of this technology. The original license came from USDA. USDA licensed Monsanto to do the original transformation genetic work and to create new plant material with the recombinant gene in it. With that kind of work, then created their patents. And have been producing and giving licenses out to all farmers that want to use this technology. If we're talking about Roundup Ready herbicide, this has been, and it was made a point during the oral argument, this has been the fastest pickup of a technology probably, definitely in agriculture, but probably in history in some ways, from zero use of this technology in 1996 to today over 90-some%, and the number keeps fluctuating, but it keeps going up, of American farmers use only Roundup Ready soybean seeds. Brazil is in a similar boat, and it's used extensively in China. The major producers of soybeans around the world have adopted this, or at least the farmers on their own have adopted this. It's more expensive than conventional seed, but it gives them such ease of care. It also has been a positive type of technology for even climate change, because in the old days you would have had to till the soil. You could do that by hand, but obviously today most people would be tilling that with tractors, using fuel and producing more carbon for the environment. Now what you do is you spray a field basically once kill the weeds, the soybeans grow. There is no need to go out and keep tilling using tractors. It also reduces the ability of creating erosion, since you are not tilling up the soil. And so we hopefully will not have a reoccurrence of the Dust Bowl that we had in the 30s. So it was a sorry picture if this technology gets undermined, because no one will spend the money to do the research and put it out there if they're not going to be able to get a return on it. And so I think that point was very clear in our industry, and the Seth and others made it very clear in other industries. And in fact, there was great discussion about is there other quote-unquote self-replicating technologies that this kind of activity could undermine. And let me throw it to Adam for any more clarification on that point.
Right. I mean, Doug just did a fantastic job describing how the facts about the agricultural industry and the functioning of biotech in the agricultural industry to create what's called the Green Revolution are just tremendous, and how that was brought out in the oral argument in very dramatic fashion by Seth Waxman. And it's also in his brief, where he also touches on the broader implications of what a ruling in favor of Bowman would entail, because as he pointed out in the brief and what came out in oral argument, you know, there are other technologies that are self-replicating that are beyond just seeds and beyond just patented agricultural products, isolated DNA, viruses, bacteria, and other types of living tissue and organisms are or can be self-replicating. And it was repeatedly pointed out to the justices that starting with the very famous decision of Diamond v. Chakrabarty in 1980, where the Supreme Court held that a genetically modified bacteria is a patentable technology under the Patent Act, because the Patent Act secures, quote, anything made under anything under the sun made by man, unquote. That they have consistently upheld patents on living organisms, and that they have not exempted from the Patent Act patent protection for living organisms, which is essentially what Bowman was asking for with his self-replicating technology argument. and even more difficult for Bowman was that there are an extensive number of Supreme Court cases that talk about patented plants. There's an entire statutory regime, the Plant Variety Protection Act, that provides specific protections for plants. And there was a specific Supreme Court decision called JEM, which addressed whether the Patent Act provided protections for plants under what are known as utility patents under the Standard Patent Act, given that there's the Plant Variety Protection Act. And the answer in the JEM decision was yes, there is no exemption from the Patent Act of any technologies. And so what you have is two complementary statutory regimes providing two complementary systems of protection here. Bowman's argument would require the court essentially to de facto overrule JEM, Chakrabarty, and many others by essentially creating a, in the words of the Solicitor General, a, quote, seed-saving exemption in the Patent Act, unquote. And I highly doubt that the Supreme Court's going to do that.
All right, once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one caller in the queue at this point, so after that, our lines will be open.
I've Bill Burgess, I'm a lawyer in D.C. I've followed the seed cases for a while. I know Seth Waxman's been doing Monsanto's seed patent stuff for about 10 years, so I'm not at all surprised to hear that he performed very well at argument and that his briefs were good. My question is there anything the plaintiffs, is there anything Bowman missed or any way they could have done a better job with the case? I guess I'm surprised to hear such one-sided reviews of how it went and how the justices received this particular case, given that they granted cert in the first place.
I'll take a first stab at this. I think part of the reason why the argument went the way it did was just because you had two extremely good, well-rehearsed very knowledgeable attorneys representing the U.S. government and Monsanto, and an attorney who came across as not being as well prepared as he probably should have been in the oral argument, which is, I think, was what created this perception at oral argument that Monsanto was going to win. Now, perhaps that was just a perception created by the performances of the attorneys, and we will all be surprised when the decision comes out. But at least at this point, it seems like Monsanto will probably win. The problem, but going to the substance of your question, the problem is that, as I said earlier, at the end of the, you know, at the end of the day, this is a case involving someone who is deliberately and willfully trying to infringe a patent, trying to get the benefit of a patented technology without having to pay for it. You know, he was told, he contacted Monsanto and was told you can't save the seed for replanting, and then he came up with a scheme to try to do exactly that. And then created after the fact this argument to try to rationalize what is at the end of the day is unauthorized making of a patented invention, which put him and his attorneys in a very tough spot, and I think the difficulties that came out in the oral argument was that the argument that they came up with, this kind of very broadly stated no patents on self-replicating technologies, the difficulties with that is it has a lot of implications that, if spelled out and followed to their logical conclusion, raise all of these concerns that the justices were raising about the proper incentives for the biotech industry, about the scope of patent protection, and whether you could restrain this even to living organisms. I think Justice Sotomayor made this very good point in some questions where she said, look, you know, this really isn't truly self-replicating technology. I mean, the farmers are involved in this. They have to plant the seeds. They have to put fertilizer down. They have to till the soil. They have to spray the weed killer, the Roundup Ready. The farmers are actively engaged in a farming process, just like manufacturers are all actively engaged in a manufacturing process. And so the problem here, I think, was in the nature of the argument that they had come up with to justify this Mr. Bowman's actions.
Yeah, and I would agree entirely with that. The nature of agriculture is something that's not very well understood, and that's true in the populace at large and true for the justices also. So there is a lot of subtleties that were missed, if you wish, in agricultural practices. And unfortunately for Mr. Bowman, his attorney was also not very knowledgeable. And it was quite clear that did not have resources at its disposal to sort of at least distinguish some of the things that were being made by Monsanto's counsel. I don't think there's not that many kind of agricultural per se agricultural cases that would make it to the Supreme Court. And as a result, wouldn't expect a very strong knowledge base there going forward. Because modern agricultural practices are very far from what most of us would think of from our youth or from what we'd seen on television. And as a result, this is a highly technological industry. It's the only way that we can produce the number of soybeans, corn, cotton on much less land now than even in our youth. It's an amazing success story, but it demands protection of this innovation. And I think that point was gotten across extremely well by the Monsanto side, and the Bowman side was shooting in the dark in some ways without adequate information, and just in a sense, the end result of their victory would send us back tremendously in terms of food production, fiber production, and it would kill the biggest export of this country at the moment.
All right, final call for questions. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one more question from our audience, so let's go to what I think will be our final question.
Hi. It seems to me that the Monsanto side is being a little oversold on the benefits or the alleged benefits of this technology, and that the facts could very easily be a little bit different for the next farmer and have been, where Monsanto seeds have been blown onto properties and then grown there, and then Monsanto has gone after the farmers who've got this stuff mixed in with their natural seeds, which and the Monsanto stuff is actually trespassing on their property, and that this trespass would be a very good defense in some cases.
Well, this is Doug Nelson again. That is a potential case that has been. There have been cases of that sort with a drift. So-called contamination, even though the fields that are claiming it are usually organic and getting a premium for their self-created niche market, and it sort of reverses contract law or normal tort law, in that the person getting the premium now is suing to make sure everyone else around him ensures that he continues to get his premium. In this case, however, though, it doesn't work. There isn't that kind. These are the flowers on soybeans have their own. I forget the technical terminology, but in a sense, they pollinate themselves. There is very little pollen drift, and in fact, the pollen has been documented scientifically that it really does not drift more than. I think the number is 6 feet, and so as a result, across the border of a field is going to be pretty minimal, to say the least. In addition, there is no way that Monsanto would ever actually have knowledge of that with the little bit of fringe potential impact of a pollen drift on the other field. So in soybeans, it's not an issue. And actually, Justice Kagan was quite clear in her questioning that's probably not going to be an issue. So it is an issue in potentially other cases, and there have been some so-called trespass cases filed. Most have not succeeded for many reasons. But as I think Adam has indicated, this is not that case, and we had a much more potential scheme concocted to get around the technology license and paying the appropriate royalties for a patented product.
There's another amusing aside on a different sort of getting around the Monsanto patent. The cocaine farmers in Colombia apparently were being attacked by U.S. drug enforcement planes dropping Roundup on their cocaine crop. They just waited for the Roundup-resistant cocaine crop to spring up, and most of the cocaine is now Roundup ready, and when the DEA drops Roundup on their crop, it simply kills the weeds.
So the DEA is helping make successful cocoa crops in.
But someone actually went down to test the cocaine gene to see if it was the Roundup ready gene, and they found it was just a natural sport.
So your point about what about innocent and inadvertent infringement is an important question, and I think as Doug Riley points out, in fact, I was talking with a fellow academic colleague who was at the oral argument before the oral argument about this issue, and I said this would be a much closer case if it involved one of those situations of seeds blowing onto someone else's parcel of land, so the infringement was entirely not only inadvertent, but it was inescapable. But this isn't that case. And moreover, as Doug and I repeatedly said, Seth Glassman did a really great job emphasizing these facts that with respect to soybeans, Monsanto does not go after innocent infringers like this. And in fact, it can't happen. I mean, he actually made the point during oral argument that soybean seeds can't, because they're heavy seeds, they can't blow on to other crops. He made a joke about how, yeah, maybe if Hurricane Sandy came through Kansas or a place where there's soybean crops, that would blow seeds. But that's the level of the strength of the wind that you would require for one of these seeds to blow onto someone else's land for them to start growing this crop. And there was a very funny exchange with Justice Kagan where she said, well, what about, you know, a kid who ends up with, makes a picture out of edamame that's Roundup Ready. Is this infringing because they're making and using the seeds without authorization from Monsanto? And Seth Lastman came immediately back and said, actually, edamame is an immature seed. It doesn't germinate, so it would be impossible actually for this to constitute the type of infringing activity that you have in this type of situation. And he also emphasized the point that Doug just raised, that even in these cases where you have intermingling of seeds or pollen from genetically modified crops and other crops, there's no enforcement because first the farmer doesn't know because it's a natural intermingling. Monsanto doesn't know because Monsanto can't find out. And so they said there may be this inadvertent infringement, but there's no enforcement issue about it because they don't know, no one knows about it. They only know about it if you go out and actually test the seed or test the plants. People are doing.
Monsanto may have been overselling there because there have been Monsanto people going out onto various lots uninvited and testing their plants, trespassing, in order to determine if the infringement has occurred.
But not because of blowing, but to determine if people are replanting.
Right. Right.
And that's different. I mean, because of course farmers as defendants say, oh, I didn't do this. This is inadvertent. This is because it blew onto my property. But you have to. That's what they're saying as defendants in litigation. And if the facts don't support them, you know, soybeans don't blow onto other people's property. There's only one other way that happened.
Which is why soybeans was a good test case. But of course, they're going to try to jack this into technologies where the seeds do blow.
But remember, Monsanto didn't make this a test case. I mean, this was this is Bowman who's been appealing. And Bowman was the one who petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court, not Monsanto.
Right.
Wait a minute. Who brought the case against Bowman?
Well,
did Bowman do this as a declaratory judgment?
No, Monsanto sued for infringement.
Right. Okay. So Monsanto initiated the case. Bowman is simply taking it up to the Supreme Court. I guess it was the wrong case for him to do. There's another interesting side effect that happens here. Very often farmers try to rotate their crops. And then they want to kill off the seeds from the previous crop because it's not what they're raising on that field, at which point they can't use Roundup because the soybeans, which are now a weed in this newly planted field, pop up and are Roundup resistant. It's an interesting side.
Gentlemen, this is Dean Reuter breaking in here. Appears we're out of time and we're also out of questions from our audience, and I apologize. We have a hard stop at the 60-minute mark here. So with that, I do want to extend the thanks of the Federalist Society to Professor Adam Ossoff and Mr. Douglas Nelson for joining us for the call today. To our audience, as always, thank you for joining our call, and I hope you'll be able to join us for our next scheduled Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing recess appointments and the fallout from the from some recent litigation developments there. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.